It is 8:30, but I think we should wait for a minute or two to see if.
Dr. Davy
Okay.
is just joining the meeting right now, it appears. Hello, Dr. Davy.
Good morning, everyone.
Okay, so
good morning.
We can go ahead and get started, Mr. Diner, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. The time is now 8:30 a.m. on August 19, 2020, and I call the meeting of the Complaint Screening Committee of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. Ms. Michelson, would you please call the roll?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Davy?
Present.
Mr. Diner?
Present.
Dr. Gill?
Present.
We have quorum.
Thank you. Now, I do realize Dr. Davy may have to leave at 11:30, so we will try to wrap up before then. If that doesn't happen, we will consider taking a break or proceeding with two committee members, myself and Dr. Gill, which is the minimum number required for quorum. So I do want to cover a few preliminary items. The Complaint Screening Committee, pursuant to Arizona Revised Statute 32-2081, subsection H, may dismiss the complaints appearing on this agenda or refer them to the full board for consideration and action. Complaints dismissed by the committee shall not be disclosed in response to a telephone inquiry or placed on the board's website pursuant to ARS 32-2081, subsection H1. Upon a vote of the majority of the quorum, the committee may go into executive session on any item on the agenda pursuant to ARS 38-431.0382 to review confidential records, or A3 to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. For those in attendance, please be aware that the chair reserves the right to change the order of the items on the agenda based upon parties present and requests to speak. A person or a representative of a person who has filed or received a complaint and is present at today's meeting may make a brief statement to the committee when prompted by the chair. The committee may also have questions for those who speak. Please use...
Looks like we have everyone.
Thank you.
Good morning, Dr. Davy.
Please use only initials for patients, and I can't stress this enough. Please use only initials for patients or children. Be aware that the content of many records involved in these complaints is confidential, and the content should not be discussed in a public meeting. Be advised that the committee will go into executive session to discuss any confidential records. So having covered those important preliminaries, the first complaint to be discussed today is complaint number 20-44 for Elizabeth Capps Conkle. Dr. Davy, you are the lead committee member for this complaint. Would you please provide the committee with an overview?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The summary of the complaint is as follows. The complainant alleges that Dr. Capps Conkle was scheduled for a meeting on or about the 17th of October at 2 p.m. The individuals were told the visit would consist of observing a son with the complainants for about 30 minutes to 1 hour, and that the parents would be evaluated individually. The complaint suggests that that took longer than that was disclosed. Dr. Capps should have let the son and one of the complainants go home rather than wait in the waiting room. That's the first complaint. The second complaint has to do also with scheduling around an observation with those that would be present or not present during such a time. The complaints suggest that Dr. Capo Conkle should have been able to deal with any sort of behavioral problems that may have arisen for their son. There was a lack of a report of what occurred in the session, according to the complaints, and they were not told again who was going to be, in fact, present during that time. The third allegation has to do with a bonding assessment, which DCS had commissioned from Dr. Katz-McConkle, and the fact that it took an extreme amount of time for that report to happen, according to the complainants, with regard to dates and the efforts to get that done. The complainant suggested it took almost 11 weeks after the initial 5 weeks to complete the assessment. Dr. Katz-McConkle provided us a statement as well, suggesting that she was performing in the best interest of the bonding assessment. She had been doing that for over a decade for the state of Arizona and DCS in particular, that she did it in a timely manner. She also suggested that everything that she engaged in was in the interest of the family. She also engaged that there was an issue. She also suggested there was an issue with the referral getting through to her office manager. As soon as she found that out, she reacted in a timely fashion. Per standard practice, Dr. Katz-McConkle waited for DCS to schedule the initial assessments, even though that the complainants had in fact contacted her privately through a series of events, which was highly unusual for that to happen, particularly in a DCS referral situation. Further, Dr. Katz-McConkle stated that the son would need to be evaluated not once, but a second time. Those were included in multiple exhibits. And finally, I would just say that the Dr. Katz-McConkle suggests that all three of the allegations are unfounded and that she acted in the best interest of the family, and it did so in a timely fashion. And that concludes my summary.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Is there anyone who has requested to speak regarding this matter? I believe Dr. Katz-McConkle and her attorney is present.
I believe, Mr. Chairman. However, I do not know if the complainants LS and BZ are on the line, so it may be helpful to ask if they are here today and would like to speak.
Thank you. Are the complainants with initials LS and BZ here in the meeting?
Does not appear so, so we can go ahead and hear from Dr. Katz-McConkle and her attorney, Ms. Carvis.
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Michelson. So, Ms. Carvis, can you please introduce yourself? And I don't know if Dr. Katz-McConkle wishes to speak on her own behalf. So please go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Mandy Carvis appearing on behalf of and with Dr. Katz-McConkle, who is here with me in my office today. I'll make a brief statement and then Dr. Katz-McConkle is happy to answer any questions that any committee members may have. I think the summary that was provided was a good one. It's important for the committee to keep in mind the nature and the purpose of this evaluation, that this was a bonding best interest evaluation of this particular child, being formally retained by the state to do this. And she's done hundreds of these evaluations over the course of her career. With respect to timeliness, we believe that this was in fact very timely, considering the schedules of all people involved, that she very timely provided a report of the findings. And it's also important to keep in mind that as part of that, she was not just requested by the agency to evaluate the complainant family. She was also asked to evaluate another potential foster family as well, because there were actually two children involved, as we explained, one that they were seeking to adopt and another one that was potentially being adopted by someone else. But she was also charged with seeing, again, what is in the best interest of both of those children in terms of the various foster families. It also involved a rather lengthy process, I'm sure you've seen in the reports, of her reviewing the prior foster placements for these children. So this was a tremendous amount of work that she did. It was, I think, in light of the sheer volume of things that she received and the fact that she was continuing to receive information up until very close proximity to when she prepared her report, that it was extremely timely. It was thoughtful. She did what she was asked to do and retained to do, and that was consider the best interest of the children and make recommendations in that regard. Lastly, with respect to timing of these appointments and how long they were going to take, as we stated in the response, the family was given options in terms of when they wanted to schedule these things. They obviously know the child's nap schedule. Dr. Katz-McConkle doesn't know that. So if they would have they obviously were aware of when they were scheduling an appointment and could have attempted to do so around a nap if that was necessary. But Dr. Capps-Conkle obviously worked with them in terms of scheduling things. And again, we think that everything that she did was not only timely, but appropriate under the circumstances. And we would ask that this matter not be forwarded to the full board for consideration. Dr. Capps-Conkle is here, and I'm happy to turn the screen over to her and allow any members of the committee to ask questions of her that may have them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Garvis. You may proceed, Dr. Capps-Conkle.
And I'm sorry, just to be clear, she doesn't necessarily have an additional statement that she wants to make, but she's happy to answer any questions if any members of the committee have them.
Do any members of the committee have questions for Dr. Capps-Conkle?
Yeah, I just would, you know, if you would just take a few moments, Doctor, and walk us through kind of the complexities that you encountered in this case with regard to the fact that there were multiple previous foster placements that you had to coordinate essentially your time and efforts with to be able to interview, the fact that there were two children in foster care that were under consideration in your evaluation, and just kind of to walk us through how that essentially dictated and moved your timeline along.
Sure. So in this situation, there were siblings that the department questioned whether or not it was appropriate for them to have permanency separated from each other. And not just siblings, they were twins. So this was a highly unusual situation. Typically, there's a lot of preference for keeping siblings together, and making a decision to permanently separate twins, it's a life-altering situation for these children. The children had been placed together in three prior placements, including the complainant's family. All three of those placements were disruptions, with the exception of the son with the complainant's family. Both children had been placed with this third family, I believe, in April of 2019. And the family very quickly realized that it was not going to be a successful placement for both of the children. They attempted to work with the department. The department has their stance on what occurred. It resulted in a disruption for the brother. And the brother was subsequently placed with a separate foster family that was potentially willing to adopt both of the children. By the time I became involved with the case, both of the biological parents' rights were severed, and these children were up for adoption and ready for permanency. In observing the complainant with this child, one of the things that is really important for me is to look at that observation organically, to look at how they interact, plus to give them some structured tasks to complete. And with those structured tasks, what I'm looking for is, are they able to obtain engagement? Are they able to show nurturance? Are they able to challenge themselves with this child? And how does the child respond to them? Their observation went fine. There were no concerns. Because of the complexity of the situation, I also needed to observe this child with his sibling. At no point was he going to be alone with the sibling. I was well aware of the complainant's reasons for disrupting the brother from their home. And I was, well aware that there could be some negative interactions in my office. And I was prepared to intervene if necessary. No negative interactions occurred. And in fact, they warmed to each other after a few minutes and started to engage. Because the brother's placement was willing to consider adopting both, it was important for me to organically look at what the son looked like in a room with his brother and the potential adoptive placement. In some ways, I also felt that this was a positive situation for the son because, as far as he was aware, his brother was removed from the home because he was bad, and that was the end of his contact with him. So being able to see that his brother is okay and he's placed with nice people, that did provide him with some level of closure and left him without those unanswered questions of, well, what happened to my brother? Although they did have several traumatic interactions, that is still his twin, that is still his brother. And it would be unusual for him not to have questions about that in the future and moving forward. Additionally, through the process, because there was some discrepancy between the complainant's reports of what had occurred and the department's reports of what had occurred for these two children, I felt it was important to speak with both of the prior placements. One of the placements had since moved out of state. Another one was still in state, but had some time requirements of when she was most reachable. Through my conversations with the first placement, they raised the question of potentially providing permanency for both of the brothers. They requested my input on recommendations for what it would take therapeutically to bring the brothers back together and have that be successful. After they spent some time thinking on it, they decided they did not want to provide placement for both, but were only willing to provide placement for the brother. They made that decision, I believe, on November 15th is when I was made aware of that decision. Throughout this process, I was in regular and constant communication with the DCS case manager, who was legal guardian for these children at the time. And she was aware of the first placement's consideration during that period of time and decided that it would be appropriate to wait and complete the report after they had made their decision. In reality, it was important for me to know if there were even any possible placements for both of the children. And in the end, there were not.
Thank you, Doctor. Just one other question in reading through the documentation. Can you discuss the occurrence where the brothers were essentially approached by the other foster parents and some of the discussion around what occurred during that time? And that I believe that the complainants referenced several times in their documentation back to you that it was quite upsetting to their son. Do you have any more insight besides what's in the reports? Again, I've read through them. Just wanted your take on that today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, this was a really stressful situation for the complainants. You know, they wanted to adopt their son, and they wanted to be given approval for that. And the department did not want that to happen. Through my on the day that I observed the two brothers together again, there were no concerning behaviors. The child never appeared distressed. I interviewed him after the observation. He did make a statement that he was, from his perception, he was told by his foster father that if he saw his brother again, that he would move with him. I know the complainants made statements that the child had said that he was asked if he wanted that the other foster parents to be his new parents, if he wanted to live with them. Those statements did not occur. So my only conclusion is that, you know, the child had his understanding of what his foster parents were thinking and wanting. And those were righteous fears of his. If he was of the understanding that if he sees his brother again, that means that he would go live with him.
Thank you, Doctor. I have no further questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Dr. Gill, do you have any questions?
Yes, I do. Dr. Capps-Conkle, from reading this information and the records, it does appear that there was some issues of communication that you had with the prospective foster family, LS and BZ, regarding, for example, waiting times and how long it would take for this process to complete itself. The impression I have is that they were not clear as to the length that all of the evaluations that you had to conduct and the length of time that it would take. And there was also the incident where the father and the child were in the waiting room, and there was some apparent misunderstanding about whether they were told ahead of time that you would have a issue with a babysitter and that you couldn't see the father and child at that time. And that includes part of their allegations. And the reason I mention this is because in reviewing the records, I didn't see an informed consent with this particular couple, LS and BZ. Did I miss something? Was there a written informed consent with them?
Absolutely.
I didn't see it in the record.
It should be included. I apologize. We'll try and figure out what page number it is.
I see the consents on page 335 of the file starting out, Dr. Gill.
Well, there is a... what I found in the consent were consents from another foster parent, and not these particular foster parents.
They should all be included. There should be four of them, one for each of the foster parents that were included.
Okay, if that's the case, then I have no further questions.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. I have no further questions for Ms. Garvis or the doctor. So I think at this point, the committee should begin their deliberations. Please note that the deliberation is the time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, or attorneys representing the licensees. Dr. Davey, since you are the lead member, would you please begin the deliberation?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think at this point, in reviewing the documentation and listening to Drs. Capps-Conkle walk us through a description of the complexities around the case, I do see Dr. Gill's point around some of the communication breakdowns. However, in my review of the documentation, I did not find it to be convoluted. I thought the doctor did a good job of expressing how long different things were going to happen in multiple modes of communication. And so I did not, that did not to me raise any concern. I understand that these situations are complex and emotional for multiple parties involved, and I appreciate that. And however, in reviewing the information and the complaint, I fail to see anything that rises to a statute or a rules violation. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Is there any further discussion or deliberation? Hearing none, is there a motion?
Yes, Dr. Davey, I'll move the complaint 2044 be dismissed as there's no evidence of violation of statutes or rules by the licensee.
Is there a second?
Second.
There is a motion and a second to dismiss the complaint. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say nay. Hearing none, the complaint is dismissed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Garvis.
Have a nice day, everyone.
The next complaint on our agenda is complaint number 20-48 for Sharon Esonis. Dr. Davey, you are the lead committee member for the complaint. Would you please provide the committee with an overview?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The summary of the complaint is as follows. The complainant has alleged that the doctor passed a professional judgment on his character and ability to parent, which he claims directly led to his ex-wife denying him contact with his son. There were multiple pieces of documentation that were provided that include a letter from the complainant to the doctor requesting details around his what he refers to as his evaluation. There are also information with regards to included from the complaint with regards to the results of his ex-wife's decision to essentially restrict contact from his son. There was also a point made in the documentation that the complainant wasn't aware that he was being evaluated by the doctor with regards to his suitability as a parent. The complaint is summarized as such as saying that there was a fail to respond to requests that the complainant has made, that the complainant believes without his consent that there was an assessment conducted, and that based on the doctor's advice, he has been restricted or was influenced by his, or the doctor's information influenced his ex-wife's decision to restrict access to his son. The doctor responded in with a substantial amount of information that we went through with regards to this. Point one, the complaint or the doctor states that she never considered the complaint to be a client of hers in Arizona. Further, she states that in no way was information that was discussed with the wife based on any sort of psychological assessment of the complainant, but rather on information provided by the ex-wife. The doctor also states that the son's safety was her sole consideration. The doctor talks to us through her response with regard to the fact that she was in Arizona from, I believe, 1997, and then relocated to California. I think that was in like July of 2006. At such time, she began kind of converting her practice away from psychology and into life coaching, which I believe she's been engaged in since 2007. The doctor provided us information about her relationship both here in Arizona under as when she was a psychologist, as well as information as she was a life coach. There was also information provided by the complainant with regard to the individual misrepresenting her the doctor's certifications. As noted in our reports and documentation, there does appear to be a bio that is incorrect and needs to be updated. The doctor states that she has updated that with regard to her practice and her position. And we will get to that, I think, in some of the discussion. That concludes my summary, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Is there anyone who has requested to speak for this complaint?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we do have the complainant PH present as well as Dr. Essonis, so I believe we will start with PH and see if he would like to make a statement.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Will the complainant licensee please speak up and state your name for the record? If you're a complainant, please state your initials only. The committee may have questions for you during this time.
Thank you very much for allowing me to speak. My name is PH. I'm calling from Italy, so if there's a problem with the internet connection, please forgive me.
Understood. Please proceed.
Okay, I think it's very important that you realize I'm not trying to rehear my divorce. And if I just give you a short chronology of what happened, maybe that will enlighten you to the problem that I feel at my end. So I'm an ex-serviceman. I was a special forces pilot in the British military, and I fought in three wars. And I was diagnosed with complex PTSD after serving in Bosnia, which was the worst war zone, if you like.
And this is Jean, the board's attorney. Please don't feel compelled to reveal any diagnoses on the record.
I've got no problem, ma'am. I'm completely open about my life, and I feel it's yeah. But thank you very much for your concern. Okay. And it's something that I receive treatment for, actually for the rest of my life on occasions, just to make sure I'm seeing the world correctly. So I married my ex-wife. I met my ex-wife in 2004, and we had our son, HH, in 14th of May 2007, and we married subsequent to that on the 13th of May 2013. And because I was a long-haul pilot, spending some time in Europe and some time in America with KK, life was complicated, and on occasion, we come from different backgrounds, we come from different nationalities. KK used Dr. Sonis very regularly for her wash and brush up, which I have no problem with. And on two or three, and I cannot remember if it was two or three occasions, we went to see Dr. Sonis just for some coaching and you know, just to solve differences that all couples have. And I was very happy to go and talk at that level. At no point did I ever give my consent for, was informed that I was being formally assessed, for anything to do with PTSD. It was purely, if you like, we weren't married at the time, marriage guidance. We moved to Italy subsequent to our marriage. We bought the house that I'm currently sitting in. But I had an issue at work, which was subsequently disproved, but it took a year and a half. And after a year and a half of some quite difficult times, KK felt she could no longer stay with me, which is her sad decision from my point of view, but this decision that she took and I respect. And she took my son back to America from Italy. And we let things rest for 2 months. And after 2 months, I visited, I believe, about three times. That was in 2014, 2015. And the agreement was I would go over, we'd reestablish contact, we'd be happy as a family, we'd be happy that HH could see his dad and the relationships were normal. In that time, I volunteered $140,000 to reestablish KK back in the States, and I volunteered monthly maintenance. And the reason for that is these things can go horribly wrong. And I was just trying to show willing. It was very unfortunate why we split up. It wasn't KK's fault or my fault. It was just circumstance, and we just couldn't get through it. Then what happened with these visits, there was an agreement that in the August, HH would come and visit me for 3 weeks in the UK, / Italy. And slowly that was withdrawn. So I paid for two visits, one to Italy where my house is. I was then working in India, and KK came over with H, and we tried to get things going. And I couldn't understand why this visit was withdrawn. It was out with the direction things were going. It was as positive as it could be in a marriage breakup. You know, we were working together for HH's future. And I just couldn't understand why suddenly this visit had been withdrawn. And at that point, rather than, I believed it was a bit spiteful and trying to be life controlling for whatever reason. So I said, well, look, let's rest it. I don't want contact. You can't control my life through my son. let's go and get divorced and see what the judge has to say. So we first went to court in Milledgeville, Georgia, which was KK's hometown. And KK's attorney gave a great speech. And my position was quite simple, which is that we didn't need to fight. We just needed to come to an adult agreement about the future of our son and work in our best interest for his future. And after some deliberation, we decided to reinstate the visit. So the agreement was I would go over to the States for a couple of occasions, and then after that, he would come and visit me at my home so we could have a father and son relationship. And what then happened was just before my first visit to the States, a pile of paperwork arrived that was effectively setting me up to fail, which was to do with what I had to sign, what I could and couldn't do, what I could say to my son, where we could go, who we could see, who we could visit, and all sorts of bits and pieces, which I refused to sign. And that was it. So we held the divorce hearing subsequent to that, and it got quite heated. I still couldn't understand why the position had changed so hugely. And in the divorce hearing, I have PTSD. I'm not good at conflict, so I avoid it. And I just said, look, I can't fight this. I just need to get divorced. So I got divorced. The last time I saw my son or any contact at all, sorry, I've written it down, it was 2015 in December. He's 13 now. And I've puzzled ever since why KK changed so abruptly. I had absolutely no idea. I believed that I was acting honourably. I believed in volunteering financial support and everything, that I was showing my willingness to be, you know, a good father. And it wasn't until the COVID crisis came up where I emailed KK and just said, look, you know, what provisions have you put in place for our son? And I got quite a vitriolic answer, and a number of emails went through. And then completely unsolicited, she said, I totally accept responsibility for denying you access to your son. It was as a result of Dr. Osonis' assessment of you, my words, and some views of some of her friends. And I was a bit surprised at that because I've never been assessed. And so like anyone, I sort of went on the internet and found that Dr. Osonis was supposed to be a member of the American Psychological Association. And I asked them the details of their complaints procedure and their conduct regulations. And they said they'd never heard of her. And I sent a copy of the webpage and they said, no, sir, we've never heard of this lady. We suggest you contact Arizona Psychological, which I then did. Reading through the code of conduct, I think they're very good rules, and they're there for everyone's protection. And clearly, Dr. Osonis passed a professional judgment. Her only relationship with KK is a professional relationship. They don't go for beers. You know, they don't meet socially, as far as I'm aware. And that I would be liable to lash out and damage my son. Again, my words, but I think that. And it's based on absolutely nothing. And it clearly says in the code of conduct that you cannot pass a professional judgment without going through some form of science, having informed consent. And then there was also the question, really, of can you then release judgment on one person to another person, knowing it's going to be used with no form of redress, really. And so I find myself in a position, some of which is as two parents squabbling a little bit, I can accept our responsibility because, you know, it would be nice to be grown up at these times. But in the end, to find that a doctor I'd been to quite openly to discuss PTSD and how that works in a married relationship could just off the cuff effectively say, you can't let your son go anywhere near him, he might lash out. And I've been a good father for 8 years, as far as I could see. And that really is my position. Sorry if it was long-winded.
Thank you. Do any of the committee members have questions of PH?
Yeah, this is Dr. Davey. I think my question overriding in reviewing the documentation, from your view, from your standpoint, What leads you to believe that an evaluation, a psychological evaluation, at one point you referred to it as a psychiatric evaluation, yes. What makes you believe that that occurred?
I don't believe one did occur, sir. I believe that at no point was I formally evaluated using any scientific process whatsoever, which leads me to the conclusion that you can't then form a judgment on my suitability to parent. If she did perform a psychological evaluation of me, then she needed my informed consent and was not entitled to release the results. So either way, how did she form that opinion? Forgive me for answering the question.
So when I look through the information, so let me just make sure I'm understanding. So you're essentially saying that there was not a psychiatric or psychological evaluation done on you, which would have led to a rendering of a professional opinion with regard to your disposition. So that did not occur. What documentation, will you orient the committee members to documentation that you provided that suggests that a professional opinion was rendered on your statement? And I know you pointed to the one letter for us where your ex-wife says that she's relied on information from friends and the doctor. Is there
from her friends, which is always a bad thing during a divorce. So my ex-wife stated that, and I believe in your introduction, so that you stated that Dr. Sones did say that she passed comments. I've got no idea of the contents of private conversations, professional or otherwise, between Dr. Sones or my ex-wife. All I know is that there was an abrupt change of approach. It did happen after the India visit for no discernible reason that I could tell. And it was years later, completely unsolicited, that I had this email from KK stating that it was due to a conversation and an opinion of Dr. Sones. And I don't believe as a professional that is appropriate to pass judgment on me as a father with no formal evaluation, or if there was a formal evaluation, I was never aware it was being carried out.
Thank you so much for that answer. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
No further questions for me, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Dr. Gill, if you have any questions.
Yes, PH, thank you. In reading these materials, it was my impression that the recommendation from Dr. Sones was that your son, pardon me, your son could not visit you unaccompanied. But you're making remarks that your son was prevented from visiting you under any conditions. Do I have that right?
Okay. Forgive me. I don't find it acceptable, having previous 8 years of being a highly responsible father, flying from all positions of the globe to be with my then wife and son, looking after him, babysitting him by myself, with no concerns ever expressed, that suddenly I've become a bad father overnight. And KK has, as much of us do, and I it's not a criticism at all, because I require it at times because of my PTSD, gone to Dr. Sones, and I believe Dr. Sones was a force for good in supporting KK through life, but I don't believe she was in a position to make these comments fairly on me. And so what happened is, in these situations when you're getting divorced, you need everything to sort of work, or the suspicions on both sides, sometimes founded, sometimes unfounded. And we just reached a position where basically I knew something was wrong and couldn't put my finger on it, but I was not prepared for my ex-wife to control me through my son. My PTSD just does not allow me to be in that position. I also did not wish to damage my son. And I've seen other fathers go through it where mum's late, or that they can't make it, or this, that, and the other. And it was the pernicious way the visit was reduced from 3 weeks to 2 weeks to 1 week. Then it was moved to somewhere else, and then this, and then that. And then there was some more paperwork. And it just became a controlling exercise. And I now know, rather than KK being in any way vicious trying to control me, she didn't feel she could tell me the truth for whatever reason. And the truth has only just come out. And the truth is, she couldn't, she did for whatever reason, she felt she couldn't tell me, she couldn't trust me to see my son. And the reason is, because of the doctor's advice.
Yes, but the question I asked was, the doctor's advice seemed to be that she was not approving of unaccompanied visits. Not reduced visits, not about visits that were accompanied, but only visits in which the child was not accompanied. Is that correct?
So, I'm not actually fully sure from the email that was put there, but if you look at it in a practical point of view, I'm a reasonably articulate adult human being. I don't live in continental America. I wish to have my relationship with my son. I don't wish to have my ex-wife's relationship with my son. And so I elected to avoid being controlled through this and to avoid the pernicious way that the visits can be altered, people can be late. Basically, my ex-wife, as she clearly states in her email, actually was telling me untruths, and I elected to have no contact at all. So the decision to have no contact at all was mine, because I felt that the contact that was being offered was not fair and constructive to my relationship with my son, because I do not have anyone else's relationship with my son. I have my relationship, for better or worse.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Sorry, I find this a little bit stressful. It's a bad subject for me.
Thank you. Dr. Esonis, if you're present, will you please proceed with your statement? And then the committee members might have questions to ask you.
Dr. Esonis, can you please unmute yourself? It's in the left-hand corner of the screen.
If you're on the phone, there may be a different process to unmute yourself.
Yeah, she would have to go on her phone and hit the unmute button. Dr. Esonis, can you please unmute? Unfortunately, there's no way for me to unmute her, so we'll have to wait.
Excuse me, this is KK. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
The instructions that I received when I signed into the meeting were *6 unmutes, and if she's on her phone, that's what will do it.
Thank you. Dr. Esonis, if you can unmute yourself by pressing *6, that might help us connect. Ms. Galvin, should we maybe table this item to give Dr. Esonis time to figure out how to connect, and maybe we can circle back to the item? Is that permissible?
Yeah, perhaps maybe a 5 or 10 minute comfort break and give Ms. Pakanon and Ms. Michelson a chance to reach out to the doctor to see if they can assist her in unmuting herself.
Okay, yeah, that should work. So let's maybe take a comfort break until it's 9:19. So maybe we should come back around 9:25. That will give 5 to 6 minutes for everyone to figure out how to get Dr. Esonis on the line.
I will contact her. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. We are on break.
I unmuted my end. They had it on mute. Hello?
Dr. Isinis?
Yes, I am so sorry. I've been here since 8:30.
It's okay. So we're happy that you joined. We actually are on a 5-minute comfort break, so we will be resuming at 9:25, and then the committee members will hear from you, okay?
Oh, thank you so much. Please apologize for me. I can't
Not
believe
a problem.
It.
Just hold on for a couple minutes.
Okay, this is 9:25 a.m. Do we have Dr. Davey and Dr. Gill?
Present.
Thank you, Dr. Davey.
I'm not sure if Dr. Gill is back yet.
Present.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. Again, this is 9:25 a.m. This is the Complaint Screening Committee of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners. We are back from our break. Dr. Essenes, are you on the line?
I am on the line, and I would like to profusely apologize. So sorry.
That's perfectly okay. We all, you know, have our troubles with technology.
I have more than most, but that's, yes, so
thank you.
I'm here.
Do you wish to make a statement, and then the committee members might have questions for you afterward?
Very good. Thank you so much. I never considered PH to be my client in my Arizona psychology practice. I was asked by my client, KK, if she could bring her boyfriend to meet me. Her boyfriend, PH, was visiting. He lived in the UK at that time. Over the years in practice, I have often been asked by clients to meet a friend or family member, and never did any of those people interpret this as a counseling relationship. I did not have PH or any visitor fill out an intake packet. Therefore, I had no consent for treatment or evaluation. PH was returning to England shortly after the appointment, where he was seeing his own therapist. I never did an evaluation, and I never had a conversation with KK about this topic. The appointment in which KK brought PH to meet me in my office in Mesa, Arizona. It was not long before I closed my Mesa practice, relocated to San Diego in July 2006, and in 2007 started a coaching practice. In the information that PH provided to the committee, he says that he and KK saw me two times between January and April 2012. I had no contact with either of them during that year. In fact, the only contact I've ever had with PH was in 2006 and a phone call in 2008. In October 2013, KK contacted me for the first time in 5 years. Besides being way off on when the appointments occurred, this time difference is very significant because the state of the relationship of these two people was far different in 2006 than in 2012. In the appointment in Mesa, they appeared to be enjoying each other's company, seemed to be in what's often referred to as the honeymoon period. Their biggest problem was finding time to be together, which was hard since they lived so far apart. Things changed in December of 2011 when PH had an incident with his British Airways manager and chief pilot that led to his being placed in a disciplinary process that lasted many months. According to KK, the situation radically changed his behavior and things between them. In 2012 and 13, there were serious problems. This is when PH's behavior became unpredictably violent and suicidal, and thus a major issue for them as a couple. KK had observed road rage and outbursts before this time, but this escalated to a whole new level. PH was, according to KK, drinking heavily during this time, which made matters worse. KK had great difficulty knowing what to do to make sure he didn't hurt himself or others. She contacted the police, the union rep, and other professionals, including PH's therapist in the UK, to seek guidance and help. She really believed he might take his own life. This was a horrible time for her, and all the while she was caring for their young son.
Mr. Thurman, this is Jean Galvin. I'm concerned that we are getting into information that was probably provided to the doctor during therapy sessions. And
yes, that is my concern as well. Thank you, Ms. Galvin. Okay. Dr. Essanis, if you can please refrain from divulging confidential information received during your consultation with KK. That would be much appreciated.
Yes. I had no contact with KK from 2008 to 2013. During this period, KK sought help on numerous occasions from a female psychologist in Maryland. PH joined KK in one session from her, with her. From what I can gather, the reason for this complaint has to do with the advice I gave KK and H about HH visiting his father overseas. KK had been talking with friends and had decided she should accompany HH for a visit. She ran it by me, and I agreed with her that to ensure her son's safety, she needed to be there. PH is incorrect in saying that I changed her mind, that she was set to let HH visit without being accompanied by his mother. That simply is not true. KK said she was afraid to send him to visit his dad because of his unpredictable violent and suicidal behavior. She wanted to make sure she could intervene.
Mr. Dinar, do we just need to move into executive session? Dr. Ginn revealed information about PH that she most likely received in communication or as part of therapy with KK.
I'm sorry, PH. This is a time for Dr. Essanis.
Okay.
Thank you. Yes, Ms. Galvin. I move to go into executive session to discuss confidential information and for legal advice.
It's Dr. Davey, I'll second.
There is a motion and a second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say nay. Hearing none, we are going to go into executive session. Ms. Michelson will be forwarding the phone-in information for the executive session. Everyone else, please just stay on the Zoom call, and once we are done with the executive session, we will be back.
Yes, I emailed it to the members right now, and I also need to email the information to Dr. Isinis. So please give me one moment, Dr. Isinis, and check your email for that information.
Thank you.
Okay.
And everyone, please, members, be sure to close your video and your audio.
Yeah, maybe I had to go into executive session. Now, I'm supposed to do this again. Hello?
Dr. Isinis, do you need assistance this Friday with the board staff?
I do. I don't know what I'm doing, Jennifer. I'm so sorry. Can I give you over to my husband?
That's fine. I can provide the instructions.
Okay. I have to go to my email.
Yes, the instructions on how to call in to the executive session have been emailed to you, Doctor. There's a passcode that you'll need to enter once you've dialed in. So you need to mute this line because the public can't hear what you're saying.
I need to mute this one?
You need to mute this line, yes, while you're in executive session. We have a couple of other phone lines that are unmuted at this time. I just want to make the participants aware of that fact. So check your status, please. Thank you. PH, I think you're still unmuted.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just sitting waiting. I just sit and wait until you guys come back. I'm reading a wonderful book.
Wanted you to be aware you're on a live mic. Thank you.
No worries. Okay, I'll say very little.
Okay, we are back in regular session. This is Dinar. Do we have Dr. Davey and Dr. Gill?
I see Dr. Gill, there he is. I do believe that
I'm
Dr.
here.
Essenes will need a couple minutes to call back into the regular line.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Yeah, we'll wait for Dr. Essenes to join us. Dr. Essenes, are you here?
Do not see her here yet. And I will let you know, Mr. Dinar, when I see her join.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Michelson, do you think we should maybe check to see if she's having any tech issues?
I'm going to try calling her right now because she's not in the meeting. So, actually I see her right now. Hold on 1 second. Dr. Essenes, are you there?
I'm there. I'm here.
Thank you, Dr. Essenes. Before we proceed, this is 9:51 a.m. and we are back in regular session. This is the Complaint Screening Committee of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners. Dr. Essenes, do you want to proceed with your final remarks, and then the committee members might have questions of you? And just to remind you, the discussion we are having in regular meeting should not include any confidential information that you learned during your consultation with KK.
I understand. Thank you. I just have a little bit left. Another area that PH brought up is my bio on articles I published on selfgrowth.com between 2010 and 2013. He was correct in saying that I no longer belong to the APA currently, as was stated there. I had belonged when I published the article. I did the edits on 17 articles immediately. And then the investigative report stated that the brief information page still had it, the APA in my bio. I missed this somehow, and so I had my husband edit it to make sure everything was up to date, which it is. That concludes my statement. I would like to make a request to the committee that KK be allowed to make a brief statement on my behalf. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Esonis. Ms. Galvin, I'm not sure that KK or any sort of witness testimony should be permissible at this point. I mean, the committee is only evaluating whether there is something in the complaint for us to either refer the matter to the board or dismiss the complaint. So I would appreciate your thoughts on that.
Mr. Diner, you're correct that the complaint screening committee is not the forum to hear from witnesses, that this is just an initial review for the committee to determine whether there is evidence of a possible violation to go to the board or whether it should be dismissed.
Thank you, Ms. Galvin. Dr. Esonis, I think, as you just heard, this would not be the appropriate forum for KK to speak on your behalf. So unless you have any other statements to make to the committee members would then now like to proceed with any questions if they may have any for you.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Committee members, do you have any questions to ask Dr. Esonis?
Yes, this is Dr. Gill. In looking over this case, I have some concerns. Dr. Esonis was initially acting as a licensed psychologist, and she let her practice go in 2006 and then assumed the role as a life coach. And and I guess my concern, and maybe Dr. Esonis can comment on this, is that in her role as a life coach, she did make comments to her client regarding the issue of her son visiting his father unaccompanied. And it strikes me, it's my impression, that that is the role of a licensed psychologist with a background in child protection. And It appears that she may have operated outside her role as a life coach, and I'd like her comment about that.
I understand. I'm sorry. I just didn't see it that way. I thought, would I send my own 8-year-old over there under these circumstances? And the answer was no. That I would err on the side of caution if I were a friend telling her that, if I were her life coach. She was very concerned about what might happen. And I just gave her my best advice. I didn't see it as stepping outside my coaching role.
Did you consider a referral perhaps to a specialist who could further make a determination regarding this issue?
No, I didn't. No. This was really just a 5-minute conversation, and I just said her decision sounded very sound to me, that it made sense that she was following what she thought she should do for her child.
Thank you very much. I have no further questions.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. Dr. Davey, do you have any questions? You're muted, Dr. Davey.
Yes, I am muted. My question is simple. Did you formally assess the complainant for either psychological or psychiatric issues?
Yes, when I was in, I saw her for several years in Arizona, and she did not meet the criteria for any diagnostic category. That was why I had told her that she, if she was interested, she could take up life coaching, because I cannot diagnose or treat psychological disorders. I had discussed that with her on more than one occasion.
Thank you, doctor. My question, though, was the complaint, PH. Did you formally assess either psychiatrically or psychologically PH?
Oh, no, I did not. No assessment. I did not have his permission to do so. No one gave me any reason to do that. He was already seeing his own psychologist and had been had a assessment in UK.
The times he was in your office, I believe in your documentation, you provided some notes as to when PH was there as a guest of your patient. At any point was any documentation signed by PH with regard to the sessions that he would be sitting in or listening in to? Was there any sort of discussion around what he might hear in there? What did that look like?
No. He was in my office once, and then in 2008 I had one phone call with him. And in my office, we discussed just regular matters. I just let both of them talk, and I listened. And it was just, she brought him in to meet me. She wanted him to meet me, and that's all that happened. I wasn't giving feedback. I wasn't doing anything. Just listening to what they had to say. And they talked about various things.
Thank you, Doctor. Mr. Chair, that concludes my questioning.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. So at this time, the committee will begin deliberation. Please note that deliberation is the time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, or attorneys representing licensees. Dr. Davey, since you are the lead member, would you please begin the deliberation?
Yes, thank you. And so I'll begin just with a brief overview of what we've heard. We really have essentially the PH coming forward to discuss the fact that he believes that that the individual, the complaint, I'm sorry, that the licensee, or now the doctor, I guess, because she's inactive as a licensee, rendered a professional judgment, provided an evaluation on his disposition with regard to his ability to provide that information to his ex-wife. He goes on to further assert that his ex-wife, using that information, made some decisions with regard to the restrictions that were placed on him. In her response, the doctor states that PH was never his client, again asserting that she was a life coach with his ex-wife. We have heard that there was no evaluation on the individual, that there were no individual one-on-one sessions where information was provided with regard to the complainant's disposition. And that includes my summary. And I think from that standpoint, the discussion that I would like to have is, you know, I read through the documentation, I looked at the information. Again, we have a difficult situation here involving custody and parents and emotions running high. And looking at the complaint in its entirety, the issues that rise to concern were with regard to the inactive licensee still representing herself as a psychologist, which came out through some just of the research, and then also the information that came from the APA. I would just think that as the committee, we probably want to make sure the board staff are double checking those websites and making sure that they have been updated, at least getting documentation that the updates were requested, given that COVID-19 is most likely slowing down customer response times for the entities that are involved there. But in looking through the information, and with the utmost respect to all parties, I am struggling to find something that rises to a rules or statute violation, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Diner, I just wanted to make one comment in regards to Dr. Davies' indication about the APA membership on the self-growth website. As Dr. Essenos had indicated earlier, when she received the investigative report, it was noted that the membership was still on that website. She did indicate in a recent email to me that she had since taken it down. I did verify it this morning on the self-growth website, and the APA membership information is now taken down. So I just wanted to clarify that point.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson.
Ms. Michelson, what about the language of being licensed? Is that, and maybe we need Ms. Galvin to chime in, being licensed in Arizona? The license is actually inactive, correct? And so that language, does that, Ms. Galvin, does that need to be updated as well?
Yes, I would ask that she parenthetically state inactive if she's going to say licensed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, board staff.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Dr. Gill, do you have any items for discussion or deliberation?
Well, I did express some concerns regarding the case. This role of previously, although some time ago, operating as a licensed psychologist with this individual, and then later moving on to a life coach. Maybe if the time frame were less, we would be looking at documentation, maybe regarding termination of session, termination of therapy that would go back to 2006. But because of statute of limitations, documentation wouldn't be an issue now. So even though I have some concerns about this, I would agree with Dr. Davey that the issues here don't rise to the level of an ethical violation, or in my understanding of the law.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. I tend to agree with both of you. I think, I mean, in terms of the additional information, as you know, if Dr. Essonis is inactive, if we as the committee want to wait for her to give us confirmation that she has updated her online profile with the inactive parenthetical, then one option that I see is to continue for obtaining that further information, or I mean, we can as is suggested, dismiss the complaint. So I kind of wanted to see where the committee is, which of those two options the committee is inclined to proceed with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would ask Ms. Galvin, are we allowed to dismiss this complaint and then pending board's board seeing that the parenthetical has been added, or do we have to wait till it's actually been done?
I didn't hear your last part. Or do you have to actually
can we essentially make a motion that we are going to dismiss this pending verification that the inactive parenthetical has been added?
So the motion could be to dismiss upon receipt of proof that she has added that parenthetical. I would be okay with that.
Very good. Then I so move that the complaint be, complaint 2048, be dismissed upon, Gene, I'm going to miss that.
Upon receipt indicating that she has added a parenthetical to her letterhead and whatever she uses indicating her license is inactive. Staff will make that determination and then send the letter of dismissal out.
I so move.
Is there a second?
I second.
So there's a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Hearing no further discussion, let's call for a vote. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed, say nay. Hearing none, the motion carries. Complaint number 2048 has been, Ms. Galvin, help me, dismissed based on...
upon receipt of indication that she has clarified her licensure status.
And I will follow up with her today for that.
Thank you, Ms. Galvin. Thank you, Ms. Michelson. So the next complaint on our agenda is complaint number 20-21 for Laura Falduto. Dr. Gill, you are the lead committee member for this complaint. Would you please provide the committee with an overview?
Yes. this case regarding Dr. Laura Falduto involved a case involving high conflict child custody. CF, the complainant, and her ex-husband divorced in 2010. They have three minor children. Luca, born a male, was identified as a female.
Go ahead and use the initials for the children, please.
Okay, I'm going to call the identified individual a child. The child was born male, identifies as a female. She prefers to be called by a particular name, but we will refer her here to as child. Dr. Falduto engaged in counseling with the child July of 2019 to September of 2019. The child was 12 years old. Father chose Dr. Falduto and consented for child to be in treatment. Mother did not consent. Father had sole legal decision-making power at that time. Dr. Falduto asked to provide sessions for the father and child. Mother was expected to contact Dr. Falduto to arrange for intake sessions. Care required immediate crisis intervention in this case. The child was involved in inpatient care beginning with Phoenix Children's Hospital on August 15th of 2019, and she was transferred to Oasis Behavioral Health August the 16th to August the 28th. Father helped arrange the transfer of care from Oasis to, at least potentially, to University of Utah Comprehensive Assessment Treatment Program on August the 28th. Mother disagreed, sought legal recourse in family court, obtained an objection, prohibited admission to this program. Child placed in mother's care following discharge from Oasis without transition planning, according to Dr. Falduto. Child in mother's care for 5 days, father given referrals for an IOP, or that's an intensive outpatient program. And this was accomplished August the 30th of 2019. Mother objected, did not bring child in for the appointment. Mother returned child to school. School allegedly was unprepared to handle this child without a plan. Mother told school nurse, be concerned about my child's suicidal issues. with father and school involvement, an alternative plan to prevent harm was established. There's a consultation with all parties. Court monitored care. Child admitted apparently to the manager clinic in September, lasting until October the 9th. The plan was to follow treatment to West Ridge Academy and then to a boarding school. Dr. Falduto submitted an unsolicited letter to the court on September the 6th, 2019, considering an by the complainant as an ex parte communication. Dr. Falduto was concerned about the child's imminent risk of self-harm. CF filed a complaint. Dr. Falduto's letter was biased, and she functioned outside her role as a safe haven therapist, and instead was acting in a forensic role. The complaint submitted the following. Dr. Falduto submitted this letter. It was full of inaccuracies and biases, especially against CF. on October the 24th of 2019, the judge of the court prohibited Dr. Faltuto from further involvement in the case. According to CF, Dr. Faltuto violated the client agreement to refrain from forensic work. Dr. Faltuto's letter initially was not read in court, and not clear that the report was sent to the parties. Dr. Faltuto did not understand the litigation process. The court could not consider information not provided to the parties. Dr. Faltuto's letter was contrary to the informed consent to protect the records of the minor child that the father and child signed. Dr. Faltuto, given a custody evaluation from 2015 against court order, distributed this report. Dr. Faltuto violated the confidentiality agreement. Dr. Faltuto's inaccuracies include no contact with the mother up to the time the letter was sent. Father did not comply with the law. Former therapists were recused themselves from following contact with CF, another inaccuracy. Dr. F consulted with counselors at OASIS and Phoenix Children's Hospital in a, quote, expansive role that was inappropriate. Dr. Faltuto, in a letter, referred to child sexual development was inappropriate regarding this case diagnostically. Mother returned the child to school. Father, not CF, was responsible for the planning at the school. The licensee response, Dr. Faltuto reported that she was experienced in gender identity issues, admitted that she sent a letter to the court, but it was to protect the child from self-harm. CF would on occasion prematurely raise gender-related topics with the child. She was assigned as a safe haven therapist to protect against conflict between the parents. Father required to consult with CF regarding decisions such as deciding on a therapist. CF objected to prior therapists regarding their expertise regarding gender identity matters. And she submitted a rationale regarding her decision to write this letter. It all came down to an issue of self-harm and felt that she had a duty to warn. Dr. Faltuto was hesitant to write this letter. She consulted with an attorney, consulted with a specialist in child custody, and after the fact consulted with a child custody specialist. Dr. Faltuto's attorney felt that there was a reasonable belief of risk. Dr. Faltuto further responded that she consulted with the Dr. Stahl, a custody expert, who determined that Dr. Faltuto did not violate any ethical principles or violate a standard of care. He did say that Dr. Faltuto should have sent the letter with a copy to the father and had the father copy to the mother. He also stated that she should have wrote a shorter letter with focus on the child's clinical issues. She also insisted that she acted as a self-haven therapist and not a forensic specialist. There is a supplement response by Dr. Faltuto. She denied distributing a confidential custody evaluation. She did share information with an educational consultant, but did not mention the name of the child. She also stated, Dr. Faltuto, that she met with the mother once during one of the child's hospitalizations. Mother filed a complaint in November of 18, stated it was a misunderstanding. Mother said she could prove that Dr. Faltuto inappropriately disseminated third-party records, but the proof was never provided. The Dr. Fatuta also said in response to the complaint that she took 41 CEUs that were related to this matter to further educate herself on the issue and would respond favorably to the board. And that concludes the summary. Thank you very much, Chair, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. Is there anyone who has requested to speak regarding this matter, Ms. Michelson?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we do have complainant CF present, and she has indicated she would like to speak, so we can go ahead and start with her.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Will the complainant CF please speak up, and obviously do not state your name. Please state yourself by initials only. The committee may have questions for you after your statement.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, I'm CF. Before I begin, this entire case is sealed, and I understand that it is very complicated. We have been in court since 2013. It's gone all the way to the Arizona Supreme Court. So this is pretty complicated, and I understand that. But with all due respect, Dr. Gill, your summary had included inaccurate facts in it. And so that concerns me a little bit. I would be happy to answer any questions that you have. And one of the biggest things that you did include was that I was expected to contact Dr. Falduto. And that is absolutely inaccurate. So I don't know how you come up with the summary. And like I said, I'm here and I'm available to answer questions. All right. One other thing that was inaccurate, I'm trying to just pick out the biggest things. Another thing that was inaccurate is that you said I did not provide proof that that Dr. Falduto distributed the confidential custody confidential custody evaluation from 2015. I did. That is all summarized by Judge Bergen's remarks in the final orders that I did submit. So that I consider that to be proof. My initials are CF. I'm the mother of IE. IE was assigned male at birth. But since age 5, she has consistently, persistently, and insistently identified as female. So you're all psychologists, mental health providers. You know that this is a specifically vulnerable population. Transgender children have a very high rate of suicide. So affirming and supportive parents are crucial for transgender, gender creative kids. Unfortunately, when affirming parents have to deal with the family court system and mental health providers, they are often railroaded, mistreated, and the target of character assassination. I think this is a result of professional mental health professionals, court professionals being unfamiliar with the evidence-based research that supports affirming transgender and gender creative kids. My hope is that this complaint will shed light on this harm that affects this already vulnerable population. My complaint is that Dr. Falduto has violated ethical standards set for psychologists. She endangered my child's life by aligning herself with PE, who is IE's father. The extent of her violations are clearly outlined in the documentation that I submitted. So you've got the minute entries from 10/24, and you have the final orders written on 4/14. And, you know, if I look through those, I've highlighted all the portions where the judge is outlining the problems with Dr. Falduto, there's quite a bit of highlighting going on here. So I think it's better that you hear from the judge who's familiar with all the complexities of this case. So that's why I submitted this as proof rather than, you know, I haven't talked to Dr. Falduto. I haven't emailed with her. She's never contacted me. We have not communicated. So I thought that this documentation would make things clear. So her violations, Dr. Falduto's violations involve operating outside her role as IE's safe harbor therapist, distributing confidential information without my permission or knowledge, or without the court's permission or knowledge, because from my understanding, when that 2015 custody evaluation was used in the future, we had to go to court to get the court to say it's okay to give this out to someone else. We had to get the court's permission. Dr. Falduto didn't get the court's permission. She didn't have my permission, and she sent it to Menninger. She sent it to Gail Curran. She sent it to WRA with the sole purpose of smearing my character before my child even gets to these places. So she also falsely claimed to be an expert in gender identity. She did not follow WPATH and APA standards of care for transgender youth, and thus she endangered my child's life. Another violation is providing opinions on my behavior, which is all secondhand. She's getting all this information secondhand. She hasn't talked to me. She hasn't emailed me. She hasn't called me. Nothing. She provided opinions on my behaviors, on my motivations, and my character without ever communicating with me. I would like to emphasize that during the course of her treatment of IE, Dr. Falduto never, ever communicated with me. We were both present in a Zoom meeting. This is in the beginning of October. So it wasn't during the time she was treating IE. It was after that period. We were both present in a Zoom meeting with four other people, but that is the only time we have been ever communicated. IE is now home with me and doing well. She is living authentically and receiving medical and mental health care from qualified providers who follow the standards of care. My motivation for making this complaint is to protect children from Dr. Falduto and her unethical practices. The documentation I submitted references the violations of ethics, but I would like to answer questions and provide any clarity that I can. Before the questions, I just would like to read just an excerpt from the final orders. I'm going to use initials. IE's first session with her therapist, Dr. Falduto, was on July 22nd of 2019. Dr. Falduto was an extremely poor choice by father. Although she touted herself as a gender expert, she had little to no clinical experience. She also engaged in a series of actions that were contrary to IE's best interest. This is from the judge, including sending an ex parte letter to the court advocating for father's continued sole legal decision-making authority, repeatedly criticizing mother, actively working with father to undermine mother, and second-guessing diagnoses by other more qualified professionals. Please keep the well-being of transgender youth as the priority when reviewing my complaint. Transgender youth have enough obstacles in their lives and deserve to have ethical mental health providers that will follow the standards of care and advocate for them. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Ms. CF. Do the committee members have any questions to ask the complainant?
May I make a point of clarification?
Yes, please, Dr. Gill.
In my summary, I prefaced certain categories by saying that Dr. Faltuto had reported the following. I didn't make these statements as fact. I made these statements as Dr. Faltuto's opinion. So I just want to make that clear.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. That's an important clarification. I wanted to just make an initial comment regarding that, but I'll probably reserve that for the deliberation phase. Do the committee members have any questions to ask CF? Hearing none, this is the time to then proceed with Dr. Folduto, and I believe she's represented by her attorney. Can you please state your name for the record and make initial statements? I don't know, Dr. Folduto, if your attorney wants to speak first, but I'll let you and your attorney speak to that.
My name is Mark Harrison. I'm sitting here at the table. I just raised my hand. My colleague, Travis Hunt, is also with our firm and has been involved in the representation of Dr. Faltuto. I think in the interest of efficiency, what I would suggest is this. On August 7th, I wrote a letter to Jennifer and transmitted a statement prepared by Dr. Faltuto with the understanding that it would be distributed to members of the reviewing committee. It's a six-page statement which I think accurately and in detail summarizes Dr. Falduto's involvement in this, relatively brief involvement in this matter from July till September. It's very difficult to respond to third-party statements, but it seems to me that what I would suggest for openers is this. Assuming the board has had the opportunity to review Dr. Falduto's statement, I would ask that the board direct questions based on that statement to Dr. Falduto, who's here to answer them. And then I'll make some remarks at the end, with the board's permission, about this matter. And directly in response to CF's comments.
Thank you, Mr. Hunt. Dr. Folduto, do you want to make a statement or do you wish to answer questions?
As I've suggested, is this Mr. Dinar talking?
Yes, this is Dinar.
All I see is a black space, sir. It's hard for me to... it's our expectation that having had that statement for 10 days, the board members would have questions based on Dr. Falduto's statement, which sets forth her view of how this matter evolved.
I guess the only thing I would add is that anytime I made, similar to you, Dr. Gill, anytime I made a statement in the letter, I prefaced it with who made that statement, just as you preface the categories. So I just want to clarify that. That's the convention that I use throughout the treatment as well.
So we're available for members of the board to ask questions.
Thank you, Dr. Folduto. Do any of the committee members have questions?
This is Dr. Gill. I just wanted to ask Dr. Faltuto, do you feel that you acted as both a safe haven therapist and a forensic therapist in this case?
No, sir.
Okay, even when you sent that letter?
I consulted with an attorney because in the role of my Safe Haven Psychotherapy, I, as an Arizona licensed psychologist, have a duty to protect and warn my child for my child client's safety. I consulted an attorney because in this case, and you have Holly Giesel's statement about why I consulted her, what my deliberations were about sending the letter. I didn't want to put anyone in the position of me sending the letter, but I prepared it under the advisement of counsel and submitted it under the advice of counsel.
And Dr. Gill, I think Dr. Falduto would acknowledge that she recognized that in submitting the letter, she was necessarily going beyond the traditional bounds of a safe haven therapist. But she felt a very strong ethical obligation to do so, and that was supported by experienced counsel. So I can't answer categorically that she knew or intended to be a forensic evaluator, but she understood that she was going beyond the typical bounds of a safe haven therapist when she sent that letter, but she felt she had an affirmative obligation to do so.
Well, thank you for that clarification.
Dr. Gill, I was trained to do child custody evaluation and parent-child bonding studies and provide forensic documentation to the court as a matter of my postdoctoral fellowship at the Menninger Clinic. And I have not pursued that line of work. I've only worked as a psychotherapist. And I revere the separation of the boundaries between those two roles.
Okay. And you feel that, let me ask you this. Do you feel that you violated the informed consent agreement that you made with the father and child?
Clarification on that point, the child never signed an informed consent agreement. That document is prepared to educate parents about the difference between forensic roles and therapeutic roles so as to protect the child's record. And no, I do not feel I violated that consent. That consent is designed to educate parents and to help parents stay within the boundaries of the psychotherapy by not submitting the record.
And Dr. Stahl's comment that you should have sent a copy to the father and have the father copy the mother, do you have a comment about that?
Both my attorney's affidavit and my statement explain that according to a 2018 court order, my understanding was that all therapist communication was to be directed to father, who was responsible to share it with mother. And when I attempted to give father this letter, he refused and his counsel refused to accept it. I then consulted with my attorney again, and she advised me to proceed with submitting the letter to the court directly.
And why did you not consult with the mother, especially prior to the letter that you sent to the court?
The information that I had from father was that his perspective was that mother had interfered with the child's access to care. And this is documented again in the same minute entry that CF has cited here, the April 14th minute entry, which explained why the court advised that I see the patient before contacting mother, and that the understanding and condition of my doing so was that father was to provide my contact information to mother, and mother was to schedule her intake session separately.
Okay. And do you have a comment? There appears to be a disagreement between you and CF about the issue of your distributing this custody evaluation completed in 2015 to other parties violating confidentiality. Do you have a comment about that?
I have never in the history of my career distributed third-party records, and I did not do so in this case.
So, but you did consult with an educational consultant, I believe that's her title, regarding your concerns about this case, but you did not mention the name of the patient. Is that correct?
My practice is to contact a placement consultant, provide her with basic information, but not the child's name, ask if she would be willing to take the case, and then refer the case to parents.
So this is a...
Refer the placement consultant to parents so that they can choose to or not choose to use her.
And this is a practice that you've engaged in the past. In other cases...
Standard practice, exactly.
Standard practice. I don't have any... Well, did you document that the child was at imminent risk at the time that you sent this letter to the court?
My September 3rd progress note reflects exactly why I thought the child was at imminent risk, based on her disclosures in that session, which are cited in the letter.
Okay, thank you. I don't have any further questions at this time.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. Dr. Davey, do you have any questions to ask Dr. Fulduto?
Yes, Doctor. Can you describe to the committee, in your own words, the difference between the safe haven therapist role and that of a forensic psychologist?
Forensic procedures are distinct from any psychotherapeutic procedures in the nature, purpose, direction of the treatment is involving confidentiality. These are reports that are investigatory and evidentiary in nature to help the court make a legal decision. Psychotherapy, this differs from this distinctly in every way. Psychotherapy is undertaken with confidentiality agreements and the understanding that treatment goals are the purpose of the procedures, that confidentiality will be protected, that psychotherapy is not undertaken to facilitate any legal decision making.
Thank you. And so, as your counsel has described and you described in multiple statements, that line between safe haven therapist and forensic psychologist got blurred a couple times. Is that their statement?
Not correct.
Okay.
The role of the safe haven therapist is also in accordance with the state statutes to act in a way that's responsible to protect your child client. The basis of that consent agreement with the parent of legal decision-making responsibility is that the confidentiality of the record will be broken only when there's a danger to the child, even if that danger to the child is her danger to herself. Which is why when the injunction was placed on the direct transfer from Oasis Behavioral Health to the University of Utah, I was in a position, mom had the right to disagree with that. It's her intrinsic privilege to do so. And it's her right to engage the court to support her position as a parent. And therefore, my role was to step back when mom brought the child to Phoenix Children's Hospital and to be, as the doctor of record, provide my opinion when it was asked. And my opinion was that the child was in need of a higher level of care. When the injunction was blocked and the child was discharged from the hospital without planning, I continued to remain in my role as safe haven psychotherapist, and had a scheduled appointment the following week with the child. When she told me she was a danger to herself, I consulted an attorney because usually when a child's reporting that she is in danger to herself, and all the parents both knew this, they just disagree, and parents both behaved responsibly about this, but they disagreed on what was best. And in that disagreement, the child did not have access to the care that she needed, in my opinion, because of a decision that was made in the court. Therefore, I had to contact an attorney to find out what to do, what was the right thing, what was the best thing, what was most important, what was my duty, and how do I execute it best. And in so doing, I had to provide sufficient notice to the court about her dangerousness to herself, protect her life. My goal was to prevent a tragic outcome for this child, and my only goal was to ensure that she got the care that she needed. So as her safe haven psychotherapist, I had to prepare a letter, follow my attorney's advice, and proceed accordingly.
The question is, Mr. Chair.
I have a question, Mr. Dinar, if I may.
Yes, Dr. Gill, please proceed. Could
you briefly take us through what the response of the court and the judge was to your letter?
Are you asking me or Mr. Dinar?
I'm asking Dr. Fonsuda, I'm asking you.
I have difficulty speaking about the court, the court's actions, or anything of that, the matter of the litigation. I can only truly speak about the matter of the child psychotherapy. In my statement, I stated that I felt that there was a misunderstanding about the purpose of my letter. And in my statement, I also mentioned that I clarified the purpose of my letter, both in my letter, in my comments to the judge's bailiff when I submitted it, that I was submitting the letter under the advice of counsel, sealed, and for the protection of the child. I was wholly unprepared for reading the October 24th minute entry, in which it was clear father attempted to use my letter for a purpose for which it was never intended. My letter and everything in the letter was only directed at protecting the child and at advising the court of my clinical opinion that she was at risk to herself and that she needed a comprehensive, integrated, multidisciplinary team evaluation. What happened to my letter after I submitted it, after the child did receive the care that she needed, is nothing I can truly comment on, apart from the fact that it's most unfortunate. I was precluded from clarifying the misunderstanding that I saw in the record when the judge asked or ordered me to not submit anything further without being court ordered to do so.
Thank you. I guess one final question is, you're accused of endangering this child. And I know the comments were made before that the focus should be placed upon this child and the care of this child. You feel that you did anything to endanger this child?
No, sir.
That's all the questions that I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. If there are no further questions, the committee will now begin deliberation.
Mr. Dinar?
Yes, Mr. Hunt, yes, I apologize. Yeah, if you want to make any final statements, please.
Thank you very much, sir. First of all, let me just say that I found Dr. Gill's summary accurate. I also wanted to express my appreciation to the committee and the staff for extending the time for this hearing because of my personal circumstances. And more recently, I want to thank the staff for preparing what I thought was a very complete and objective investigative report. I will tell you, members, I've been in a number of these, and when I finished reviewing this file, and I'm not being disingenuous, I thought Dr. Falduto deserved a medal, not a complaint. She has been practicing for 30 years without a complaint. She's had advanced training. She spent a brief time, 60 days as a safe haven therapist, and she was retained by the father. She had what she's already indicated was growing concerns about child's verbalization about suicidal ideation. And she was uncertain, as she has testified, about how to proceed in the face of those concerns. So instead of just acting rashly, she contacted a very experienced attorney who I know, who may be known to members of the committee. And Holly Giesel's declaration is a matter of record in your file, and it details with some narration how she and Dr. Falduto consulted. She agreed that Dr. Falduto had an affirmative obligation to warn somebody in a position of responsibility who had the power to protect this child from the possibility of self-harm. There is absolutely no evidence that Dr. Falduto's treatment and recommendations were not in the child's best interest. As a matter of fact, one of the great ironies of this complaint is that in the first minute entry, after Dr. Falduto submitted this letter, which arguably transformed her from a psychotherapist to a forensic person, the judge implemented her recommendation. And the child went to inpatient care and had quite a bit of inpatient care, which has led to her, according to CF, she is now thriving. So the notion that Dr. Falduto's concerns, her report to the court, and the court's subsequent implementation of Dr. Falduto's recommendation negates any inference that Dr. Falduto's recommendations caused any harm. And I should add that Dr. Falduto was obviously concerned about submitting this letter. As she said, she's been practicing 30 years, has never done anything like that before, consulted counsel, and only did so after the father and his lawyer refused to submit that letter to the court. And in fact, counsel her to submit it, as did her lawyer. She also assumed, and I think she would confirm this if you asked her, that the court would share the letter with mother. Father had legal decision-making authority. In retrospect, with the benefit of 20/20 hindsight, she probably should have made arrangements to make sure that mother got the letter when it was submitted to the court. But I also reiterate that even though from the time of the initial interview with father, it was her understanding that mother would contact her for an intake interview, and mother never did that. As I indicated earlier, I believe the staff did a very excellent, thorough, objective job of summarizing this in the most recent investigative report. And I found something of particular interest in that investigative report, if it pleased the committee. The report referenced all of the potential statutes that might be applicable to mother's complaint. In particular, I was struck by the relevance of Arizona Revised Statutes 32-2061 16. U. A psychologist, a psychotherapist can be cited for, quote, failing to take reasonable steps to protect a client or patient in circumstances when the psychologist becomes aware during the course of providing or supervising psychological services that a client or patient intends or plans to inflict serious bodily harm to self, unquote. This is a classic case where the psychotherapist had reasonable beliefs confirmed by a very experienced lawyer that the child was expressing suicidal ideations and might inflict harm on the child's self. And she felt, without even reference to this statute, that she had an affirmative obligation to let somebody in power know about her concerns so that the child would be protected. And that's precisely what happened. As this committee is probably well aware, there's a very famous California case called Tarasov versus Board of Regents, in which a psychologist failed to notify somebody in a position to protect the patient from the risk of self-harm. And that psychologist was held liable. And Arizona has followed the Tarasov case. Dr. Gill properly referred to Dr. Stahl's report. I contacted Dr. Stahl. I'm not a psychologist, even though I've been involved in a number of these. I wanted the opinion of a really experienced psychologist about what Dr. Falduto did. So I got in contact with Dr. Stahl, who's a very experienced guy, been involved in lots of forensic matters. And as you've reported, Dr. Gill, he found that there was no violation of any ethical rule or standard of care. He suggested, as we've acknowledged, that with the benefit of hindsight, it would have been desirable to give Mother a copy of that letter. But that doesn't go to the essence of Mother's complaint. Mother's complaint is that somehow, anomalously, the fact that the doctor was acting to protect the child somehow endangered the child's interests, even though the court implemented the recommendation of Dr. Falduto. I would urge the committee to dismiss this complaint. And I would add a couple of other things. I'm sure this committee understands. I've been practicing law almost 60 years. I've represented hundreds of lawyers, and I've represented a lot of psychologists. And I can tell you that the complaint against a professional's license is awful, because we all identify with the profession which we practice. And so if somebody says you're not competent or you're dishonest, that goes to your heart. And so before you take any action that perpetuates this unjustified complaint any further, I would urge you to keep that in mind and dismiss this complaint.
Thank you, Mr. Hunt. Do the committee members have any questions of Dr. Falduto's attorney, Mr. Hunt?
It's Mr. Harrison, Mr. Diver. That's okay. I've been called a lot worse than Mr.
Yeah. The name that appears on our screen, Mark, is Travis Hunt, and that's what's causing the confusion. The record will show that it's Mark Harrison who's been speaking.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I apologize. Yeah, I was coming off of that.
No problem.
So if there are no questions, the committee will now begin deliberation. Please note that the deliberation is the time for committee members to deliberate among themselves without interruptions from the complainant, the licensees, or attorneys representing the licensees. In addition, I want to say that there were some noises in the background while Mr. Harrison was speaking. So if you are a licensee, an attorney, or a complainant, please mute yourself during this part of the meeting. That would be much appreciated. Dr. Gill, since you're the lead member, would you please begin the deliberations?
I guess I have a question of Ms. Galvin. Do we need to be concerned about this ex parte communication issue?
In my opinion, as far as the practice of psychology, no.
Okay. There's clearly a long history of emotions and high level of conflict that's been going on for a long time that certainly is in the background in this case. And going over the materials, I was really trying to find whether there were any violations of ethics. There are a lot of accusations, but evidence of a violation, I had trouble finding. There are issues of did Dr. Faltuto act in any way to endanger this child? I don't find any evidence for that. The issue of violating confidentiality, I don't see any evidence that she violated confidentiality. I think that she did go beyond her informed consent agreement, but and her response was that she did so as a duty to warn, and she felt that the child should be protected from self-harm. There appears to be evidence that the child was at an imminent risk. So I find it hard to find a violation here. I'd certainly like to hear from my colleagues.
This is Dr. Davey. Dr. Gill, I think, you know, I agree with you. There is a lot of history here, and not to take away from what the complainant has had to go through and his family has had to go through. That being said, you know, when I look at the diligence of engaging outside support, outside counsel by the doctor, as well as the documentation around what she believed to be a significant danger for the child, I have difficulty finding anything that violates a rule or a statute. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. I just quickly wanted to mention initial reaction I had to the complainant questioning Dr. Gill's accuracy and integrity. I personally want to apologize, Dr. Gill, for those statements that were made by CF. This is not as a board member, this is not a role where we are taking sides, you know, between complainants or, you know, on the side of the licensees. We are looking at the record and we are looking at what is stated in the record. And that is exactly what Dr. Gill was summarizing. So Dr. Gill, if I can apologize on behalf of everyone, please accept my apology. I agree with Dr. Davey and Dr. Gill. I mean, I was looking at the record. Of course, there are, you know, this is a highly emotionally charged matter for the parents and the children involved. But insofar as the reports that were submitted by Dr. Faltuto, I just don't see any ethical violation or statutory or regulatory violation here. So I just wanted to mention or state that for the record. Is there a motion?
I make a motion to dismiss this matter.
Is there a second?
Dr. Davey, I'll second.
Thank you. There is a motion and a second to dismiss the complaint. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed, say nay. Hearing none, the motion carries. Thank you, Dr. Faltuto. Thank you, Ms. CF. Thank you, Mr. Hunt and Mr. Harrison.
Thank you,
everyone.
Very much.
Thank you very much for your time and your hard work
service.
On this issue. I appreciate it.
Can I ask a question?
No, the agenda item is done for complaint number 2021. Thank you, Ms. CF. I know this is hard for people, but this is the determination of the committee at this point.
Ms. CF, you can contact the staff later on this afternoon after this meeting concludes if you have any questions.
Thank you.
So the next complaint on our agenda is number T-20-09 for Rebecca Blood. But I also realize that we are at 11 a.m. and I know Dr. Davey has a prior commitment at 11:30. So We have a few options. I mean, we can just proceed with this complaint and then maybe take a break. And when Dr. Davey comes back around noon, we can deal with the fifth complaint on the agenda. Ms. Galvin, does that sound doable?
You may do that, or you still have two of the three members. You could also proceed with Dr. Davey. Without Dr. Davey, although we would miss him, you still have a quorum.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Galvin. So I think on complaint number T-20-09, shouldn't be that involved. I'm the lead committee member on this complaint, and I'll provide the committee with an overview. So the complainant against Dr. Blood alleges that in a report dated May 14th of 2020, Dr. Blood stated that she is licensed in Arizona. However, according to the board's records, her Arizona license expired on July 31st, 2018. The complainant also alleges that Dr. Blood offered medical opinions which were outside the scope of her psychologist license. Dr. Blood responded that she does not dispute the issue of listing the Arizona license on her report, but says that the complainant, MW, did not attempt to communicate with Dr. Blood regarding any of the concerns that were noted in the complaint. MW submitted a rebuttal statement in response to Dr. Blood's peer review report, but did not address the Arizona license as an issue in his statement. For several months in 2018, Dr. Blood held an active license in Arizona and Texas. Due to this overlap in the active licenses, Dr. Blood's signature block contained both license numbers for Arizona and Texas. This was, as Dr. Blood stated in her response, an unfortunate oversight and administrative error, which has since been corrected. Dr. Blood did not intend to deceive, mislead, or otherwise imply that she had an active Arizona license to practice psychology. In her report, Dr. Blood did not mention or offer any opinions related to anything in Arizona. Additionally, Dr. Blood stated that she has not presented herself as having an active Arizona license since July of 2018. That completes my overview of the case. Is there anyone who has requested to speak regarding this matter?
Mr. Diner, the complainant, MW, does not appear to be present today. I've not heard from him in any capacity, but Dr. Blood is here today and I believe would like to address the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Dr. Blood, if you could please state your name for the record and make a statement if you wish to do so. The committee may have questions for you during this time.
Thank you, and good morning to the committee. So I'm Dr. Rebecca Blood, and I actually don't have any additional statement to what was already made in an effort to not waste the committee's time. But I did want to make myself available for any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Blood. I do have a question. I believe the board informed you that they do not have jurisdiction over the medical opinion portion of the complaint. Do you want to speak to that?
To the medical portion of the complaint?
Yes.
Sure. So as you can see in the documentation and in the actual report, it's in my opinion that I did not offer any opinions outside the scope of my license. I think that there were several times where I responded to a question that referenced a medical doctor's opinion, and rather than restating that that it was the medical doctor's opinion, I answered the question. All of my responses, though, were certainly based off of any opinions or statements that were already rendered by a medical doctor. And on that note, I'd also like to add that I'm an active duty military psychologist. And so I'm actually a medical services officer in the military. And quite often I'm referred to as a medical officer. And so it also did not jump right out at me when somebody, I guess the term medical opinion, that it was improper to respond to something like that. I should obviously be using psychological opinion. I think that's part of that. That's certainly been a learning point for me, and it has since been corrected. And I now know going forward that no matter what environment I'm working in, psychological opinion is obviously the appropriate term to use rather than medical opinion.
Thank you, Dr. Blood. The other question I have, and then I'll turn to my colleagues to see if they have any questions, is that in your response, you stated that the signature block, which stated the Arizona license number, was an unfortunate oversight and administrative error. Could you please speak to that, and under what circumstances was the signature block added to the May 2020 report?
Yes, sure. So I work as an independent contractor for Medical Equation, the business, I think, by that you can see at the top of the letterhead. And so basically when there is a report that they need me to look at, they send me the shell of the report. So much of the basic information is already filled in. My signature block is already there. The disclaimer at the bottom is already in the report before I start working on it. As you previously mentioned, there was a time when my Texas license and my Arizona license did overlap, which is why they were ever both on the signature block at the same time. Once my Arizona license did expire several months later, I of course let Medical Equation know about that. However, I now see that that wasn't something that was fixed or taken out of my signature block. I do in the end take full responsibility for the fact that it did show up in my signature block, because that's up to me to obviously examine and double check. And again, I think that's a learning point for me going forward. That is something that I do look at every single time now.
Thank you, Dr. Blood, for that clarification. I do not have any further questions. Dr. Gill, Dr. David, do you have any questions?
Not for me.
Thank you, Dr. Gill, Dr. Davey.
I have no questions at this time.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. So since there are no questions, we will now proceed with opening comments for discussion and deliberation. So since we are in deliberation, please note that deliberation is the time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, respondent, or attorneys representing respondents. So since I'm the lead member on this, I'll begin the deliberations. I think, there are two parts to the complaint. The one is the allegation that Dr. Blood offered medical opinions, and I think we just don't have jurisdiction over that, and the board has already so informed Dr. Blood with regards to that. In terms of the second portion of the complaint, the allegation is that essentially Dr. Blood stated Arizona and the license number in the signature block, and she did not, for example, indicate whether, it wasn't an inactive license, but if it was, then she would have, put a parenthetical saying inactive. Or if, as is the case here, it was an expired license, which was expired in July of 2018, there probably should have been a parenthetical saying that the license has since expired. I don't believe that identifying that at some point the person held a license is necessarily a violation of our statutes and regulations. But in terms of that clarification, maybe that prevents people from misconstruing the information supplied in the signature block. But having said that, I'm not sure that because we are dealing with someone with an expired license, I'm not sure if we have jurisdiction on that second portion of the complaint as well. But I'm asking Dr. Gill and Dr. Davey for your thoughts on that matter. And maybe at some point, Ms. Galvin, if you can give us some, you know, some of the lay of the land from a legal perspective on that. I would appreciate that as well.
If I may, she does not hold a license in Arizona. She did not hold a license at the time that this conduct occurred, but you may find that she had held herself out as a psychologist able to practice in Arizona. So it would be more of a title violation than unprofessional conduct of someone who is already licensed here. So it would be whether she is holding herself out inappropriately and contrary to statute as being licensed in Arizona, or is it an administrative oversight. With respect to the first issue and whether she was offering medical opinions, you're correct that this board would not have jurisdiction over that, but you could refer to the Texas board if you believe that there was potential overstepping of her role there and let Texas investigate.
This is Dr. Davey. I have just one question with regard to the VITA and the data validation. The screenshot that came over to us, board staff, was a little bit fuzzy. Can you just verify the date of the VITA for us for the record?
What page are you referring to, Dr.?
A PDF. It is attachment 2, documentation of the file. This one up and where do I have that? Please go ahead. It's a screenshot of the individual's computer system. Sorry, my PDF thing is frozen now and getting me a wheel of death. It's right after the individual's, after the complaint.
Oh, I see what you're talking about, page 38.
Thank you.
Yeah, a date of 2018. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, is that the date of creation?
Yeah, it might not appear as clear here, but in what she sent me, I can see that it said 2000, I believe, 18.
Okay. And does it have a month on it or just the date?
Let's see. It does have a month. I'd have to go back and see the exact date.
Yeah, I think my point is that, you know, there is overlap with regard to the VITA and the licenses and... is her responsibility, which she has stated, to make sure that signature block is correct. I don't feel as if there was any particular harm there or being held out as an Arizona psychologist. That's my opinion on that particular matter, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Dr. Gill, do you have any items for discussion and deliberation?
Just briefly, I certainly... agree with Ms. Galvin. It doesn't appear that we have a purview over the over issues regarding Dr. Blood engaging in commentary outside of her scope of practice. It does appear that she did write a report in which she had an active license, and it does appear to me to be a title violation, even though it's now since been corrected. And so I would agree with that perspective.
Thank you. I think with that clarification, I'm inclined to, maybe have the full board take a look at it. I mean, my personal view on this is when I read the report, I view the signature block as, you know, just for informational purposes. I mean, they, you know, many people, you know, put in addresses, phone numbers, and qualifications in the signature block. There may be some disclaimers in there, and to the extent that the signature block by itself is to be viewed as someone holding out that they have an active Arizona license, my personal view is it doesn't seem to me as a title violation, but I also realize that may be a minority position on the board. So I would be inclined to refer this matter to the board, to the full board, for consideration on that point. On the medical opinion point, I think when I read Dr. Blood's report, I believe at least from the way that the report describes the evaluation, the report is kind of essentially copy-pasting a medical opinion that a medical practitioner had given. So in essence, Dr. Blood was relying on someone else's medical opinion and then using that to do her psychological evaluation. So in that sense, I mean, in terms of thinking of whether this is something that needs to be referred to the Texas board, I would be inclined not to refer this matter to the Texas board. But again, I mean, I may be, you know, in a minority there. So those are kind of my inclinations. So if someone, you know, wants to make a motion, feel free to do so, or else I'll make a motion.
Well, I make a motion that we move this case T20-09 to the full board for consideration with respect to a possible title violation.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. We have a motion. Is there a second? Okay, I'll second for purposes of discussion, Dr. Gill. So we have a motion and second. Do we have further discussion? I mean, I'm, as I stated, a bit on the fence with referring to the full board. So Dr. Davy, do you have any?
Yeah, I mean, I really just don't see it. Like, I agree that it was there. It's been rectified. There was an explanation to it. It was not someone trying to practice in our state, trying to hold it out. In my opinion, it's something that if it goes to the full board, that's most likely going to be where we land. I'm not gonna. It's not the committee decision. Like, I get it. If we want to scan it through the purview of the other psychologists on the board, I'm more than happy to let that be. But in my opinion, I don't know that that's necessary.
Thank you, Dr. Davy. Ms. Michelson, will you please have a roll call?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Davy?
No.
Mr. Dinar?
No.
Dr. Gill?
Yes.
Two yeses.
The motion fails.
Yes, the motion fails. So I believe I will then make a motion to dismiss case number T-20-09. Do I hear a second? We have a motion and a second. Can we please have a roll call, Ms. Michelson?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And just to clarify, who seconded that motion? I couldn't hear.
Dr. Davy did.
Okay. Okay, I'll go ahead and do the roll call. Dr. Davy?
Yes.
Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Gill?
Yes.
The motion carries 3-0, the case will be dismissed.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Thank you, Dr. Blood. The case is dismissed.
Thank you to the committee for your time today. And for what it's worth, Dr. Walker actually filed complaints to the Texas Medical Board as well as the Texas Board of Psychologists about this same issue. So if that alleviates any of your concerns about other boards, be notified they happen.
Thank you, Dr. Blood.
Thank you.
So at this point, we are at 11:20.
Mr. Chair, my meeting has been pushed, so we can continue on.
Perfect.
Four of the participants are caught in another meeting, so I don't know where I stand on that one. I'll remember that next time.
You know, sometimes we just can't predict how long these meetings are going to go. So, you know, I appreciate that, Dr. Davy. So I think we can just proceed unless, you know, someone wants a very short comfort break. I think the next one, I'm the lead member as well, so I can maybe go ahead and summarize and, you know, start the process on that case. So hearing no one wants a comfort break, the last complaint to be discussed today is number T-20-10 for Sonia Steen. I'm the lead committee member for this complaint and will provide the committee with an overview. The summary of the complaint is as follows. The complainant alleges that on June 9th, 2020, complainant's wife received a flyer in the mail from Ms. Steen in which she referred to herself as the AZ Stress Doc. The complainant then checked a few websites and came across Ms. Steen's Instagram page in which she identifies herself as a, open quote, counseling psychologist, close quote. The complainant was unable to find any license information for Ms. Steen on the board's website and therefore filed a complaint requesting that the board investigate this matter. The complainant is not Ms. Steen's client, but rather a concerned licensed psychologist. Ms. Steen responded as follows. She said she does not operate or offer services as a psychologist. She offers, quote, life coaching, counseling, close quote, services only. Ms. Steen hired a social media company to help her with marketing strategies who based the text of the Instagram account on old materials Ms. Steen had provided them. To answer questions of board staff, Ms. Steen responded that Instagram was quickly reworded after she received a copy of the complaint. So as of June 15th, 2020, Ms. Steen's website stated that she offers counseling, open quote, close quote, but her Instagram profile indicated she is a, quote, counseling psychologist, close quote. As of August 4th, 2020, Ms. Steen has removed the word counseling throughout the website and states that she provides life coaching rather than counseling, and she has removed the counseling psychologist reference from her Instagram profile. Ms. Steen, in her response, stated that her business was supposed to open in February of 2020, but has been delayed due to the pandemic. This completes the overview of the case. Is there anyone who has requested to speak regarding this matter, Ms. Michelson?
Mr. Chairman, I do know that the complainant IG is present. However, I do not know if he wishes to speak, and Ms. Steen is also here as well. So you may want to check if the complainant IG would like to make any statements.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Will the complainant please speak up if they wish to speak and state your name for the record, obviously initials only. And if you wish to speak, the committee may have questions for you after you make a brief statement if you wish so.
This is IG. I have nothing to add.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Do the committee members have any question of the complainant?
Or does she have a statement she'd like to make?
So Dr. Sonia, I'll get to you in a minute. Okay. So since the committee members do not have any questions to ask the complainant, we will now ask Dr. Sonia Steen, or Ms. Sonia Steen, to state your name for the record and make a statement if you wish to do so. And after the statement, we might have any questions to ask you.
My name is Sonia Steen. I don't really have a statement. I think everything was thoroughly covered. All changes in place. I appreciate that the committee took the time to review and to establish what has been changed. After my conversations with Jennifer, greater understanding and more oversight on how I was presented by the social media company. And I appreciate the committee recognizing that those changes have already been put in place.
Thank you, Ms. Dean. So I have a few questions to ask. Since you started your business, as you stated, in February of 2020, have you rendered any life coaching services, as you call them, to any client?
I have not been in my office since February, beginning of February. I have talked to a couple of individuals on the phone.
So would you consider the phone conferences as giving life coaching advice?
Yes.
Thank you. In terms of the old materials that you said, that you gave to the marketing strategists, could you please identify what those old materials were that you gave them?
I had a practice in another state, and items from that time period, I just threw everything together when I was trying to help them understand what I was going to be doing in Arizona. And that terminology was included in something I gave them that was really more about describing the life coaching aspects of consulting and recommendation and advice and that sort of thing. And they picked up on that. I did not review it responsibly. I didn't would do my due diligence in that.
So are these materials that you could potentially provide the board, as you said, old materials that you gave to the Instagram marketing strategist? Do you have them, and could you, if we were to ask you to do so, provide them to the board?
No. I mean, it's just a statement of, it was just a statement to them, and a lot of it was on the phone and meetings with them. It was just a statement of what I had done in my past career, which is 10 years plus now over. And I mean, I can write it down again, but basically it was just a summary of what I had done in my career and in a different state. And so I would be happy to write that down again. And then it also just included a conversation about what types of services I provided at that time and what types of issues that people might be dealing with during the current times that would be relevant.
So have you held any license from a psychologist board or a relevant equivalent board in any other state?
No.
So in
I terms held of, a licensing, an LMSW licensing.
Can you please, for the record, identify the qualification there?
I'm sorry?
The master's in?
In social work.
Thank you. In terms of, you know, these, you know, old materials, I'm still stuck on that, because we do know from your own statements that you provided some materials to them. And I just don't know where these materials came from. I mean, are these like some generic, you know, description?
It was just a statement that I gave to them that described, like I said, what I had done in my previous career, which is now over a decade behind me, and not in the state of Arizona. And basically, it was to address the types of issues that I would be targeting as far as my life coaching.
So would it be fair to assume that in the summary or the statement that you provided them, you used descriptive words like counseling or psychologist to describe the kind of services that you provide?
I used the word counseling. And they were aware that I have a PhD in psychology. So I did use the word counseling, which also appeared in the mailing that I did, and again in my website. counseling meaning consulting, recommending, advising, not a formal statement of mental health services. State of Arizona has much different guidelines for what they require. And I think I stepped in something that was unintentional. And so this resulted in, you know, the process that we're in today. The counseling, as I stated, it was not meant to be, it's stated as coaching, counseling, caring. So it wasn't stated as a formal statement of mental health types of counseling. It was more, like I said, you know, recommendations, guidance, advice, that type of counsel.
So
that's where I kind of didn't realize what the word counseling was going to mean to the state of Arizona.
So in these statements, did you self-identify as a psychologist or any word using the root psycho?
I did not.
So then it is your representation to the board today that the word psychologist was something that the marketing strategists put in there in your Instagram account on their own?
I think what they did was, is they hybrid what I had, the information I'd shared with them. I think they did, they took a counseling piece of it, and then they took the degree piece of it, that what I have a degree in, and I think they did a hybrid on that, is my understanding from talking with the person that I was using at the time.
So just a point of clarification, earlier you mentioned you had the master's in social work, and at some point you mentioned a PhD. Can you please clarify for the record the qualifications, all of the qualifications that you have?
I do have a PhD in psychology that I received in the 90s.
But you have not been licensed as a psychologist with any state board?
No.
Okay, thank you. That concludes all of the questions I have. Dr. Davey or Dr. Gill, if you have any questions, please proceed.
I have a few questions. Thank you, Ms. Sonia, for being here.
Sure.
Do you have a certification as a life coach?
Not yet, I don't. It's not required to have certification as a life coach. The state of Arizona doesn't require it. Generally, it isn't required. I am taking classes. I'm moving towards that. I think eventually that will be the goal, yes.
And it sounds like you've had, since February, 2 phone calls. But in your website, you said that you treat people for panic attacks, phobias, issues of obsessive compulsive kinds of traits, and for post-traumatic stress. Is that?
That's all been changed.
That's been changed as well.
Yes, sir.
Okay, as the
it does not mention treatment, the word treatment at all. It does list conditions in the information form that they can contact me. It does list, you know, panic, anxiety, stress, that type of thing. But it no longer states anything about treatment or specialization.
So you're clear as to the boundary between operating as a licensed psychologist and as a life coach?
I'm extremely clear at this point, yes.
All right. I think that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. Dr. David, do you have any questions?
No, my questions would just be restating what Dr. Gill just asked. And so I think I'll pass at this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. So I believe since there are no further questions, we should go into deliberations. The committee will, during the deliberations, it's the time for the committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, respondent, or attorneys representing respondents. Since I'm the lead member, I will begin deliberations. So I have a few problems with the case that is before us. I mean, my inclination at first was that the complainant here is not an aggrieved person. I distinctly know that I hold a minority position on the board in this regard, and I've stated in previous meetings my thoughts on complainants being aggrieved persons. So in one sense, I mean, as a board, we are tasked with protecting the public health, and with that task in mind, I always try to look for an actual injury that is caused to this complainant by this respondent, and that needs to be an injury that is redressable by the board. Now, I get that, you know, we have statutes, you know, 32-2084, subsection D and subsection C, that say, you know, a person who is not licensed and not exempt from licensure pursuant to this chapter, if that person uses the designation psychotherapist or any word derived from the root psycho, then that's a title violation. And we also have subsection C that says a person that is not licensed with the Board of Psychologist Examiners and uses the designation psychology, psychological, or psychologist, or any combination of those words, initials, or symbols, leads the public to believe that the person is licensed to practice psychology in Arizona, then that is also a title violation. So I have a few problems with that, because I think, I mean, what the statute, I mean, the statute, the language is what it is, but if you were to kind of take a bigger picture, I think what the statute is going for is persons who are holding out to be licensed psychologists. So in my head, the operative word is licensed, not, you know, any root of psycho or psychologist. But again, I mean, that's just my personal opinion on that. I mean, we do have statutes that, you know, clearly in plain words state that, you know, any person who uses the word psychologist to describe the services they offer, violate the statute if they are not licensed with the board. But having said that, I think, I mean, the problem there becomes, I mean, if someone just generically describes their services as, you know, giving as counseling, or, you know, as talking to people about this, it seems to me like a speech issue there as well. But I mean, you can probably hear the hesitation in my voice, because having said all of that, I do realize that I have a distinctly minority position on this with the full board. So I would be inclined to kind of take an unusual step of making a motion and then voting against it. But I think this is something, looking at the statutes and the statutory interpretation, I think we need to refer this to the full board and then leave it to the full board to make a determination. But in the deliberation phase, I do want to make clear that would want to dismiss the case for the reasons I just described. So having said that, are there any discussion and deliberation items, Dr. Gill, Dr. Davey?
Yeah, I have a question for Ms. Galvin. You know, in the past on the committee screening committee, you have an individual that clearly violated the statute in original advertisement and use of terms and titles, no doubt about that. It was brought to their attention situation, at least on the written material was rectified. You know, is there precedent there of whether or not that needs to go forward, or is there, because my underlying concern is that there is no record of this discussion or this complaint moving forward, and this happens again. And I think that because this individual is going to be here in Arizona, says she's working towards certification as a life coach, will be working, is serving as a life coach today. And so I think in terms of purview, if another one of these clear violations occurred again, I would not want us to have on the record that that this first one had occurred.
My recollection is that when these instances have come to the Complaint Screening Committee, it is referred to the full board.
Fair enough. Then, Mr. Chair, I'll make the motion to refer this to the full board for review.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. We have a motion. Is there a second?
We have further discussion, or?
Yes, we have further discussion, but because there is a motion, we could, you know, either second it and then go into discussion, or, you know.
I'll second it.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. We have a motion and a second. Any discussion?
I was looking up the, I didn't know until today that Dr. Sonia had a PhD in psychology. But I guess I'm concerned that she does present herself as a as Dr. Sonia, and there's always the risk of people being misled that she is operating as a doctor and providing care for these individuals, even though she presents herself as a life coach. It makes me a little uneasy. So maybe with that, maybe that's why I voted for the motion to send it to the full board.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, Ms. Michelson, please, will you have a roll call?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And before I proceed, Ms. Galvin, I just wanted clarification. With the motion to refer to the board, will they need to specify a potential violation of 32/2084? I don't believe I heard that in the motion.
Yes, if we can clarify with those who made the motion and seconded that that would be included as part of the motion.
Okay. So I believe, Dr. Davey, would you want to add 32-2084 subsections C and D to your motion?
Yes, I'm open to that. Thank you.
And Dr. Gill, would you second that as well?
I would second that, yes.
Okay. I'll proceed with the roll call vote. Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Mr. Dinar?
No.
Dr. Gill?
Yes.
The motion carries 2-1. The matter will proceed to the board review at a future meeting date, and Ms. Steen will be noticed of that date as well.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. So with that, we have completed all of the cases that were agendized for discussion and decision in today's committee meeting. For adjournment, do I hear a motion?
So moved.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. There is a motion and a second for adjournment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say nay. Hearing none, the motion carries. The meeting is adjourned, and this is at 11:45 a.m. Thank you,
everyone. Thank you, Mr. Dinar. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Good job, Mr. Dinar.
Thank you.
Good job, Mr. Dinar, for sure.
Yeah. Have a good day.
Everyone helped. So, yeah, this would not have been possible without, you know, the awesome support of staff. And
thank you for your support on the earlier item. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Take care.